A Walk to Ground Zero, A Few Months Later, by James Borstein. Sunday, November 18th, 2001. A brilliant sunny morning, pleased to have free time before the weight of next week drops. Sitting near the front window on a hard chair, I read a magazine article about Osama bin Laden and his family. He had more than 20 siblings by most counts. Just before noon, I biked down to my studio and noticed the streets and sidewalks were crowded. The sun was acting as a magnet to pull people outdoors. Unable to resist the force, I headed out of my studio before 1 o'clock. Walking south and west, I reached Canal and West Street. One New York City police officer and one state trooper were stopping and inspecting certain vehicles. It was unclear how they decided who to search versus who to let pass. I crossed 6 lanes of traffic to reach the Hudson. Across the mile-wide river, I counted 7 new buildings between the Holland Tunnel's ventilation tower and the Colgate clock in Jersey City. 15 or 20 years ago, there wasn't a single building taller than 5 stories along that stretch of waterfront. Today, there are more than 25. As always, it was refreshing to be near the river. The expanse of open space that a broad river provides is a tonic for those who live in forests or in tall cities. I walked a short way south before the route was blocked near Pier 25. No explanation besides the word detour, but it was apparent that the fairly new riverfront promenade was barricaded due to a transfer operation for debris coming from the pile. A gigantic red Weeks Marine crane dominated the forbidden landscape. It looked like an oddly articulated industrial-scale puppeteer with no proscenium or black cloak controlling a large yellow wedge-shaped steel bin as its marionette. Dangling in midair, the wedge seemed small, although it must have been more than 20 feet long and nearly 10 feet high. A full-size dumpster sliced diagonally from the top down to the ground at the opposite end. The puppet show was transfixing and free. The wedge was the principal character in unceremoniously transferring thousands of tons of the former World Trade Towers from land to sea. This spot was the pivot point for these architectural remains on their journey from their island home to their unknown final resting place. The impact of 2 commercial airliners precipitated a series of unusual and unexpected technological challenges. Here was a small, inspiring show of human response, executed with ingenuity and skill. I watched a full Maztec environmental dump truck position itself to empty its heavy load. There were about 10 loaded dump trucks, all shapes and sizes, waiting in line for their turn with the wedge. New York Department of Sanitation, New York State Department of Transportation, the Grace Company, and a Whitney truck, likely not from the art museum. After dumping, each truck drove off as the next truck pulled forward, driving straight south. The full truck stopped and then backed into the precise position in front of where the low, open end of the wedge would land. The red crane dropped the yellow wedge quickly, slowing just before it touched the ground, like a high-speed elevator reaching the lobby from the 33rd floor. It landed parallel to the flow of the river, less than 25 feet from the water, directly in line with the waiting trucks. The truck, in the ready position, backed all the way inside the wedge, nearly to its rear vertical wall. Just before the truck started to back up, a guy standing beside the wedge turned on a fire hose. 2 hands were needed to hold the thick hose as it sprayed water over the truck's bed. The back of the truck tilted up to be nearly vertical while being showered. Depending on the configuration of the load, the mangled mass either dropped into the wedge with 1 loud burst or fell with several smaller crashes. Some loads were surprisingly quiet. All were dark, twisted, tortured. There was an ample opportunity to anthropomorphize the wreckage, mostly as stick figures with broken and distorted body parts. The truck then pulled slowly forward, allowing any remaining parts of the load to drop and distribute into the wedge. As the truck exited, its backside lowered to horizontal. Then the empty truck drove off, probably returning to the site to collect another load of remains before coming back here again. The same cycle had been continuing, probably 24 hours a day, for weeks. Then the invisible puppeteer jerked the strings, and the low-walled front edge of the colossal wedge tipped up slightly to contain its new load. The crane gave a burst of black smoke and then lifted the wedge with its tons of steel 25 feet in the air and, with barely a breath, swung it out over the river. Directly above an open barge, it stopped and dropped straight into dumping position. The wedge paused for a nanosecond, catching its breath before another burst of black smoke. The wedge reoriented from horizontal to vertical, and the charred load dropped onto the bobbing boat. Then the empty wedge adjusted its base to be parallel with the water, lifted, and following the identical arc backwards, swung toward land to receive the load from the next truck. A second crane, older, higher, and in command of a more rusted wedge, was just south of the first one. On this glorious warm fall Sunday afternoon, it was still. Other southbound walkers arrived. Most stopped to watch the industrial choreography before detouring. It was compelling, graceful, precise, and with an unlikely human feel. Onlookers stayed for a full cycle, or like me, lingered longer. At 2 p.m., the second crane came alive. Perhaps the operator was back from lunch. There were no waiting trucks in its queue. Like the trucks on land, several barges and one tug were lined up on the river, ready to receive their load of ferrous carnage. Barges hold a lot of material, more than what can fit into 10 full railroad cars. Moving material over water is far more energy efficient than moving it by roads or rail, even more so if the load is very heavy. Water supports all loads, usually without any infrastructure to build or maintain. Occasionally, a truck's load wouldn't dump. Often the problem was a twisted piece of steel wedged crosswise in the truck's bed. A mid-sized dinosaur-looking machine on bulldozer treads would approach quickly to pick the stuck steel out. I watched one of the pried loose pieces mistakenly drop over the side of a dump truck. It looked like a piece of kindling, but it was large enough to crush a car. After less than two cycles of the second crane, I could see that it was operated in a more cowboy style, faster with less finesse than the first crane, which operated more like a ballet. With my attention back at the first wedge, I watched a white New York City dump truck. It didn't back into the wedge like all the others. Instead, it dropped its load in front of the wedge, like a bad puppy missing the newspaper target. The fresh dump was sprayed down, and like in an early King Kong movie with jerky mechanical motions, the large pieces of steel were maneuvered into the waiting wedge. Was this a new driver who did not know that he was supposed to back all the way into the wedge? Or maybe certain loads could not be dumped directly onto the wedge's floor to prevent perforating it. This was a complex operation with many issues to balance, but it all appeared simple, like with good artwork. With no trucks ready to dump, the show paused. I moved on, recrossing the West Side Highway in order to continue south, around the shuttered shoreline. At Chambers Street, I turned and walked west across the highway again toward New Jersey, along the northernmost section of landfill. This section of the island of Manhattan was deposited into the river back when the World Trade Towers were only a gleam in the developers' eyes. Before that, there was only river here, water striped with piers reaching out to the west. I stopped again, south and west of my first position, to watch more of the wedge show from a different angle. Here I could see that both of the crane puppeteers were perched on huge work barges out on the water. I had not noticed this important detail from my original vantage point. Typically, construction cranes have sturdy bases to brace their high towers against their leverage loads. But here, everything was afloat. Continuing westward on the 1960s landfill, I noticed several EPA air monitoring devices that had been installed just beyond the rear facade of the Stuyvesant School, each one powered by impossibly long extension cords. There was no telling who reads the data they collect or even what kind of information was being recorded. I walked on. Electricity seemed to sparkle off the river's surface as I continued past the school, cutting southward across the goose-shit-covered great lawn of the Battery Park City development. To the east was a row of mostly empty, riverfront, high-rise apartments. Despite the paucity of people, the area looked largely unchanged since September. I sat for a minute directly inland of the Hoboken Jersey City ferry terminal, just in front of the fairly recently completed New York Mercantile Exchange. A few seconds later, a guy walked by the exchange's front door, shooting video. A guard rushed out and stopped him. "Let me see your camera," she said. He resisted. The filming and the interaction ended. As I walked around the corner of the exchange, the expansive glass winter garden atrium came into view to the east. It may be the largest glassed-in space in this city, and the last time I was inside it, there were more than a dozen full-size palm trees. At first glance, the arched top and its tinted glass facade and roof appeared intact. Most of its western side, the one facing the Hudson River, was still standing. But as I kept walking, I could see that nearly all of its eastern side was ripped open, a wounded building. Behind it, on the other side of the void, where the towers once blocked the view, was the Millennium Hotel. The dark tower, shrouded in red construction netting, appeared much taller than it did a year before. The North Cove boat basin, just west of the Winter Garden, was empty but for a few squeaking docks. Not one rich person's big boat or small corporate racer remained. Walking along the southern edge of the North Cove Basin, past the black stone wall of the police memorial, I noticed an impromptu shrine like one I had seen earlier at West and Canal Streets. These small shrines are in all sorts of unexpected locations around Lower Manhattan. This one had a more permanent feeling than some. It was more alive than the expensive and immortal police memorial with the flicker of candles and assorted recently left objects. It was strange to see dead, fully dead flowers still in their plastic sleeves as though they had just been purchased. I continued southward with West Street on my left and the river on my right. Passing through Battery Park City's small retail area, the food shops, dry cleaners, and restaurants remained mostly closed. Shop windows had signs with phrases like, "Welcome back, we'll reopen soon." It was a surreal landscape. Gardeners pressure washed both trees and vehicles. National Guard personnel milled around with respirators, but no weapons. Police, ASPCA, and various other uniformed workers were peppered into the mélange, and unlike the previous 2 months, not a single gun was in sight. Just south of where the towers once stood, I passed the entrance to the VIP viewing platform. Workers washed and rewashed the already clean cement sidewalk. South of the site, all the streets were open. Moran's Ale House in the old St. George's Chapel was open, according to a sign spray-painted on a bedsheet. But no one was around. The large street-level windows of George's Lunch Shop on Greenwich Street displayed color Xerox images of the little restaurant shut shortly after September 11th. At first glance, it looked like the pictures had been taken during a blizzard, except the snow was off-white. I realized that the yellowish snow-like substance was the cremation remains of the towers. The picture revealed how much had been cleaned up and offered a clue as to why so much pressure washing from above and below had been happening. At Rector Street, the public could turn east and get very close to the southern edge of the World Trade Center site. I was the only one around, and in front of me was an unobstructed view of a section of the former facade. A fragment, if there can be such a thing at this enormous scale. The fragment was a section of facade from the very top of the building, with the pointed arches, which almost served as a cornice. Nearly 9 stories of building skin. Eerily, it was not only undamaged, but nearly perfectly vertical. A few months ago, this piece had been part of a hole and 400 meters in the air. Now it was at eye level. The landscape surrounding this displaced section was devastated. Endless, low, crumpled architectural wreckage. Black, except for what had rusted in recent weeks. One after another, trucks left the site. Before each pulled away, it was hosed down and covered. Though they headed south on Greenwich Street, it seemed likely that they turned around and headed north to visit the wedge. Where else could they be going? A few police officers stood around the gate, huddled near a small, intentionally set trash can fire, the type of blaze that would normally be made by homeless people. Things were upside down and yet normal.